Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I'm joined by Drs. Scott Keith, Adam Francisco, and Rod Rosenblatt. We are on episode 7 of the History of the Reformation. We have been trying to go through week by week and bring you a couple years' history through the Lutheran Reformation as we can. Last episode, we talked about the Peasants' Revolt, Thomas Münzer, and the Bondage of the Will. And then we ended that episode on Luther's marriage. Today we are going to be moving forward with some of Luther's personal life, visitation articles, and some of just what's going on in Wittenberg. This is actually, the next couple years are a very tragic time in the Reformation. Right before we move into confessional documents, there's just a lot going on. And so we're going to just go through the timeline and try to give each one of those things a couple minutes here and there. Before we get into the topic, we are part of the 1517 Podcast Network. You can go to 1517.org/podcast to find more of the shows. And this episode is brought to you by 1517's Academy and the Academy Lectures. So you can go to the 1517 website, and under the resources page, there's Academy there. And we actually have a new Academy series by Dan Van Voris, who is doing something in line with what we're doing on the show right now. And he's doing I think it's a 12-lesson series on the Reformation and the history therein. And so you can go and do that. Unlike the Thinking Fellows, there's lectures to watch, not just listen to. And then there's material to engage with also. Dan has written lecture notes and outlines that you can go through, as well as there are quizzes at the end, so you can see how much or what you retained or what the instructor actually thought was important to remember at the end of it. So I think it's a very useful resource that goes along with what we're doing right now. Okay, so we ended, I think, 1526, if I remember correctly. 1525, 1526, Luther got married. And we did touch on some of the things that are going to happen, namely in the next couple of years, Luther's going to start having children. And part of that is pretty tragic. They have their first child, Luther's, I think, Elizabeth. Yeah, Elizabeth. And she dies a year later. So there's something, you know, Luther's first child dies very young. And so you see sort of that this is still not a well-timed infant mortality. Adam, during the late Middle Ages into the Reformation is pretty high. Yeah. This is common.
Oh, yeah. Not as common as it was earlier in the Middle Ages, but it's still pretty high. It's not rare that a woman dies in childbirth. And it's pretty common that children don't survive past the first couple of years.
Yeah, and so Luther's sort of experiencing something that, I mean, a lot of people talk about Luther and the pastoral care he took for people and many of his letters of consolation to people suffering. And, you know, as we kind of look, he's not going to be a stranger to the suffering himself, which is maybe why he's such a good preacher and writer towards people of this time period. When we talked about the difference between Melanchthon and Luther, we sort of highlighted that Luther was a peasant, like an every man's man. I think that'll probably contribute to his ability to do this in documents that are coming up.
I might also add, just to the east of Germany, the Turks are deep into the heart of Hungary. In 1526, the Battle of Mohács takes place, where the king of Hungary is killed. Luther writes a commentary, a reflection on four psalms that he dedicates to King Louis. What that means, though, in terms of big geopolitics, is so you've got the Ottoman Turks at Buda and Pest in 1526 converting the what's called Matyas Templedom, the cathedral there, into a mosque. So the borders of the domain of Islam are, 200, 300 miles away from Germany.
That's really close, so, yeah.
Yeah, and it's pretty tumultuous time internally and externally.
Isn't this one of the things that keeps the emperor from sort of dealing distinctively with Luther?
And yes,
sort of, in a sense, protects Luther because the emperor and the armies are busy with the, what they call it?
Yeah, it's more the protesting princes who will, starting the mid-1520s, use the need for northern German troops to deal with the Turks, the protesting princes will use that as a way to bargain for the protection of not just Luther, but the Protestant Reformation. A book was written many, many years ago in the 1950s, I think, by Stefan Fischer Galati, that argues that very point and goes through imperial diet after imperial diet and looks at all the negotiations and how the Turks were the major factor in keeping the imperial forces at bay and dealing with Luther and the Reformation.
That term, just for the listeners' sake, that term, the protesting princes, is eventually pretty... I always kind of connect it to the Augsburg Confession and the signing of the Augsburg Confession in 1530, where we get the idea or the word Protestant.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, or the...
I think you find it first used in mid-1520s, Diet of Speyer, maybe.
Yeah,
pretty early on.
So they're basically, so at this point, we're transitioning to where they are being defined as other. Not only is Luther excommunicated, but sort of the movement as a whole has been identified by Rome.
To interrupt here, but as Rome views it, this is just, there's no distinction among these Protestants.
Right.
They're all heretics. And it's not until, like, the Diet of Augsburg that you have...
People who sign their name.
Yeah, and you have these real clear confessions. Mm-hmm. In 15, is it 27 when the Anabaptist Confession, the Schleitheim Confession was written? So it's around this time that these... Protestant groups are now starting to coalesce, differentiate themselves between.
It's probably pretty good for Lutherans, considering the damage that we talked about when we talked about the Peasants' Revolt and its association with Anabaptism and radical reform, and how you definitely, if your goal isn't to burn everything, you definitely want to separate yourself from the group that is burning everything. And so now to catch up with Melanchthon, what's going up in Melanchthon's life a little bit. We didn't actually dedicate time to this, but we did talk about their existence two episodes ago. Visitation articles is going to, Melanchthon starts writing these in 1527,
1528. I mean, what's going on if we go to 1526? There's a lot going on, but one of the big things that's going on is that Luther and the Elector authorize people be sent out to congregations within these protesting states or these Lutheran estates as they're kind of becoming known, and to essentially interview teachers and pastors to see what they know, what they know of the scriptures, and generally what they know too. Like, are they literate?
Yeah.
Are they able to teach other people to be literate? When they do this, are they able to communicate the basics of Christian doctrine? Do they know the creed? Do they know the Ten Commandments? That kind of thing.
Yeah.
And as these visitations are made, and Melanchthon is heavily involved with writing the survey, I think you'd call it, questionnaire, that they sort of, these visitors take out with them.
He's an administrator.
Yeah, he's heavily, he is, and he's heavily involved with sort of, and you have to think of him as an educator. He's heavily involved with writing the questions that will determine how are we educating in the schools and in churches and whatnot. And when these all come back, I mean, the results are, to Luther, I think especially, they're somewhat terrifying.
Yeah, the low level of Christian knowledge.
Yeah, the low level of knowledge really bothers Melanchthon. The low level of Christian knowledge bothers them both, but I think it especially vexes Luther. Now, as is typical in situations like this with Luther and Melanchthon, they both get the same data and they don't have the exact same response to it. Mm-hmm. And in Melanchthon's teaching, this is very much, so 1526, 1527, where you can see Melanchthon start to rely on what will eventually be called the third use of the law more. In other words, this it's not called that yet in 1527. That doesn't happen until, distinctly until later, like 1535, maybe even 34. But at this point in time, he starts to say that the law needs to be preached in order to press down the idea of a free grace or a grace that that allows the sinner to go on sinning. And you know, the big thing that sort of comes out of this, a couple of things, or you said the visitation articles, right? And this is, these are articles that are put together based on the surveys that they get back.
And put together by Melanchthon that'll then be put into use.
Primarily by Melanchthon.
Yeah.
I don't want to underestimate, though, and Adam can correct me if I'm wrong on this, I don't want to underestimate the fact that there are many Wittenberg figures that are unsung that were likely involved in all of this. And so when you say, I mean, that's one of the big contentions against Melanchthon as the author of the Augsburg Confession, right, is that there was a big collaborative effort in a couple of documents that came before the Augustana that were used as a basis for the Augustana. And that's the case, you know, I think that's the case with Luther's translation of the Bible. I think that's the case with the Visitation Articles. I think it's the case with most of those things that kind of come out of Wittenberg as a representation of Wittenberg. Not so, say, with Melanchthon's Loci Communis or with Luther's Small Catechism, although there was some collaboration on that too. But with something that comes out of Wittenberg as a sort of a formal representation of Wittenberg theology,
yep,
there are others involved.
Luther will refer to it as our theology,
yes,
in the plural.
Yeah.
Robert Kolb will refer to it as the Wittenberg Circle.
Yeah, or the Wittenberg Way. Mm-hmm. I've heard him say that. Mm-hmm. We've got a book on that, but Kolb is great on this stuff, by the way.
He's defining.
Yeah, he really is.
I'm going to put his, I've read that recently, and it's really great.
Yeah.
He's got the one that's distinctly called the Wittenberg Way or Method.
Wittenberg Way.
Mm-hmm. He's also got the confessors define the church,
yeah,
which also then identifies who that is and what that means. He's got a lot on this particular area of sort of the development of Lutheranism. Mm-hmm.
With in connection to the visitation articles, even as far back as 1524, you have attempts. It's already recognized that there's a big problem in these Protestant eras,
right,
or areas. There's you know, you think when Luther's at the Wartburg, you get the Zwickau prophets come and visit Melanchthon. He has no idea how to deal with them.
Yeah.
And already, I mean, it's starting to everything's starting to fall apart, or everybody's going their own way, right? And so Nicholas Hausmann was a friend of Luther's. He's tasked with visiting parishes in Zwickau, where the Zwickau prophets were from, 2.5 years after they had made their appearance in Wittenberg. So it tells you, you know, we don't have all the sources we want or need to know exactly what's going on, but it tells you that the further you go out from Wittenberg and Luther's immediate sphere of influence, the more people are coming up with, they're building on Luther, and they take Luther's teaching as giving them freedom to kind of do whatever they want. They've become very, episode that Luther was no revolutionary. These other groups are very
revolutionary. There was no libertine either.
Right. They're trying to, if you will, to use modern language, deconstruct the church entirely and build something completely new in its place. And that is not Luther.
No.
Yeah.
No. So it's going on almost immediately after the Diet of Worms.
And in a sense, if the Roman Catholic Church as the primary authoritative body is, I don't want to say eliminated, but is not the standard any longer, then there's no standard. And that's why this starts to happen. Eventually, that's why you'll see the writing of Lutheran confessions, right? It's because there's no standard. And so in the 1520s, there's no standard. Saxon visitation articles are probably some of the first standards that come out that are from, you know, officially sanctioned by the elector from Wittenberg, from the Wittenberg faculty. And I was going to say, Adam, I mean, one of the things, there's a lot of things that the visitation articles try to fix, right? They try to fix general education. I mean, general, broad sort of education. Who should be educated? What should they be educated in? A lot of it focuses around theological education and theological education of the youth. I think hoping that as the youth come up that, you know, they're the future laity in a sense and that can support the pastor in that way. But also the surveys themselves, the visitations themselves provide a map for as the faculty of the University of Wittenberg graduate students that will eventually go out into calls as pastors, where a Wittenberg pastor is most desperately needed.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a lot of ways, Kolb argues this too, it provides a call map in a way.
Yeah, you get Luther responding, I forget which, Church and Ministry 2 or something like that. There's letters from Luther during this time period of churches saying, how can we call a pastor? How can we get a pastor? We've been separated from yeah. church.
And so they end up dealing with a lot of this because who else is? And they're not a seminary, they're a university, but they are graduating the theology students that will guide theological teaching, at least in the Saxon states, for 100 years. Mm-hmm. And it's why when later on you get the small Caldic Wars and the University of Wittenberg is shut down for a time, is that it's so devastating not only to Melanchthon personally and whatnot, but to the Reformation generally. Because this is really a hub. A hub for learning, a hub for the Protestant movement, the Lutheran movement, and a hub for how do we get pastors to congregations.
And again, one of the things that we can't and we haven't underemphasized is the importance of having an elector behind you who was willing to put a stamp on all of this so they could actually be a state that was saying, you too can have some of this freedom.
And he was Roman Catholic to the core. His elector.
Yeah. Yeah, Frederick the Wise was, with one of the largest relic collections there.
Yep.
Yeah.
Not even a half mile from where Luther lived.
And yes. They deal with it. I mean, that becomes a question pretty early, too. But, I mean, not to get off point, but to lead into kind of what I was trying to get to. So you have the Visitation Articles come out. There's and you can see in the Visitation Articles, in Melanchthon's authorship, this emphasis of teaching the law. And the necessity of teaching the law.
Well, because part of it, I'm sure, was debauchery and behavioral, too.
Well, it's a lot of like what Adam said, you know, that even going into Zwickau and Zwickau prophets and Melanchthon not knowing what to do. I mean, he's sort of figuring out, okay, well, what do you do with this? And his solution is they got to know the law, and which immediately pops up some, but mainly one sort of hardcore, I'd say really hardcore Lutheran follower of Luther, Agricola, who comes and literally sort of turns that on its head and says, you know, no, the answer isn't to teach them the law. The answer is that they need to know the gospel. And it literally uses passages like Romans 10:4, Christ is the end of the law, to say, you know, there is actually no place for the preaching of the law in the Christian pulpit any longer.
Goodness.
And from that point on, you have what becomes known, and year after year after year after year, right? It's going on today, to be honest with you. You get this antinomian controversy, which just means no law, right? The idea is it proper for the law to be preached in Christian congregations, or is it not proper for the law to be preached in Christian congregations because they're already Christian?
Yep.
And it's hard to... Well, maybe it's not in our day and age, actually. It's hard to, in a sense, communicate how much this war of words devastated the people involved. Mm. And again, maybe in our day and age, it's actually pretty easy to communicate that because we see that like crazy. But this...
You can see somebody's whole life ruined in 30 seconds online.
Yeah. I mean, Luther literally calls this fight between Melanchthon and Agricola a useless war of words. Hmm. By two people that are obsessed with words.
Really?
Yeah. The eventual, and I assume we're getting to it, the eventual outcome really is that Melanchthon and Agricola can find no peace on this. And they keep writing to one another and writing about one another publicly, and it becomes more and more poisonous as they do this from both of them. Years down the line, what you'll get is Luther stepping in and basically telling Agricola that he has to stop.
Yeah, five times.
Yeah.
And each time Agricola says, I will.
Yeah. And what's funny is I get the sense that initially Luther steps in on the side of Melanchthon because it's Melanchthon. In a way. Not that he's completely worked out this out in his head yet, but that he steps in on the side of Melanchthon. His encouragements for Agricola to stop are slow and they build, right? So that by much later than we're going to go today, he's actually told to stop. And when he doesn't stop, Agricola is actually removed by the elector from his position, and there's plans to put him on trial. The only thing that saves
for him... For heresy or for heterodoxy?
I think for heterodoxy, and I think... for disobeying Luther's command to stop. Mm-hmm. His elector is the sword, right? Luther holds no sword. The elector is the sword. And so Agricola, I believe, escapes this whole thing just by moving. He moves. He goes somewhere else to teach. sort of takes himself out of the direct sphere of influence.
That's one way to do it.
That's one way to do it, yeah.
Walk away.
I mean, the long story short on this, which hasn't been short, but the long story short on this is that Melanchthon continues down this path, right? So that by 1535, you have Melanchthon developing the idea of the three functions of the law, civil, theological, and the law that's for Christians. And Agricola keeps on his line, too, and this controversy keeps going for years and years, and there's a second version of it much later in the 1550s. But Luther is unsatisfied with the solution, which has been really no solution. Also unsatisfied with the solution to the poor result of the visitations, which has been no solution except for the visitation articles, which are it's like a curriculum and a set of suggestions to be enacted in these places, which eventually leads to Luther's solution being the catechisms. So that how do we solve this? Well, we solve this by teaching people how to teach the law, teaching them how to teach the creeds. And then you get very hardcore in his teaching, which it follows like that, right? Ten Commandments and the creeds and the catechisms, which follows in the creeds, in the explanation of the articles of the creeds, you get like 200-proof gospel in there, especially in the second and third article, just like 200-proof gospel and his explanations there. And so it very much follows what becomes in Lutheranism, our paradigm of law and gospel, and very much where we draw from the catechisms generally, but I'd say the small catechism specifically for laity as a sort of example of how this law gospel mindset works itself out in the daily life of the Christian. So in a sense, settling the controversy, saying, listen, the law has to be taught. Let me show you how it ought to be taught. And then he gets the Ten Commandments. He never goes into Melanchthon's formulation of the third function of the law or two functions of law or whatever. Luther never names functions of law. He simply says, this is how the law ought to be taught. Here's the Decalogue. Here's my explanation to all 10 commandments in the Decalogue. Here's how the gospel is taught, and then you get the explanation of the creed and what we believe concerning Christ, what we believe concerning the call by the Holy Spirit, and then you get other things like, okay, then how does the Christian act in it in daily life? Well, here's my explanation of the Lord's Prayer, mm-hmm. right? Here's the explanation of what it means to participate in the sacraments. Here's my explanation of what it means to have your sins absolved by a pastor or someone else. Here's my explanation of a table of duties for a Christian in everyday life. And so you very much get this flow. I mean, the catechism flows with life. We've done episodes on this before, so I'll shut up. But
Don't. Because, I mean, like we said, we have lots of new listeners. And yes, we've done, I think, 3 episodes on the catechism. But we're now doing it in context.
Well, the catechism flows with life. And that's the question that Luther, at least one of the questions that Luther is answering here, is this debate between Luther or Melanchthon and Agricola on how does this theology now work itself out in the church and then in the home. Mm-hmm. And so he's got an answer. Large catechism, instruction for pastors and heads of households in a sense, and then small catechism, instruction to children.
Yeah, and it's, just briefly to put what you did, it does seem like the natural evolution from visitations to sort of sending academics out to deal with issues one by one to sort of then leaning back on what the strength has been out of Wittenberg, which is write well and just mass publish it, right? And just...
Well, yeah, and I mean, with the catechisms, this is one of the first works to come out of the Wittenberg print shops that... most of Luther's works sell pretty well, but this is we'd call this viral. This goes viral. I just think, and then I'll let someone else talk. But I it's always interesting to me, after having sort of looked at this now for so many years, is that the difference between Melanchthon's reaction to something and Luther's reaction to something is always so enlightening to me. Uh-huh. Just the Melanchthon's answer is to write a system. You know, and that's his answer. That's always his answer.
Yeah, that's like when you, I mean, when you go through his formulation of law, you're like, this is very concise. It's very,
yeah, it makes sense.
It makes sense. It's very well put together. It's supported, you know, the way he documents.
Actually, literally, if you read it thoroughly, it leaves you with no questions regarding what he's trying to get across.
But like how that actually works in the Christian life, not as much there.
Well, it's sort of a paradigm of the two movements that ran like two rails in a railroad track, the Renaissance and the Reformation. And in many ways, Melanchthon is the representative of the Renaissance, as Calvin was. And everybody knew it, but Luther would say it. He would say things like, if you want this said in the language of princes, ask Philip. I'm a peasant.
Yeah.
So he knew, and he was very grateful for it. But under pressure, Melanchthon was hard-pressed in a way that Luther wasn't.
Right.
Or think of Erasmus. The Renaissance wasn't built for that.
No.
And Luther was.
Yeah. Well, and that's why, I mean, you want this said in the language of princes to ask Master Philip, and is precisely why... One of the reasons why Melanchthon is the one that's sent to the princes.
Yeah.
Like if you need a prince to be convinced to join the Small Caldic League and become part of the Lutheran Reformation, you send Philip. And he goes and does his thing. He goes and systematizes something for them that they can agree upon and that they can join and they can sign their name to, and they go.
Yep.
Yeah, well, and I think just to go back into what you're talking to, a lot of this, I mean, not the way they talk isn't only different in that the audiences, but even the language they use. So like when Luther talks about a thing and its use, he uses actual different words than Melanchthon does when you were talking about in 1534 with the use of the functions of the law. He uses two totally different words separated by 15 years or just a war of how this thing actually works with language that translated into English sometimes communicates that they're talking about the same thing when they're not. Mm-hmm. Which is just sort of, it's one of the interesting things when you're doing the Reformation. You'll see, Luther was talking about uses right here. And he was like, yeah, that was usus. Then you go, well, Melanchthon's talking about uses here in 1530. Yeah, that's officium. Like, that's, like, they're talking about different things.
I always think it's interesting. I don't want to get into what's very controversial right now. But I do always think it's interesting that Melanchthon develops the three functions or the three uses of the law. Maybe late 1534, early into 1535. Luther dies in 1546. Luther has over a decade to adopt this language, and he doesn't do it. That's sort of, it's not definitive, but it's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I have, Carl Truman wrote this little biography, a very nice biography of Luther on the Christian life, I think is the title. And he argues in there that while Luther may not have, it's been a while, but may not have used the term third use of the law. He's operating in that paradigm.
He may be.
If somebody asks me, I just bring up his explanation of the commandments.
Well, you could even say his explanation of the Lord's Prayer, his explanation of the sacraments. All these are have to do with how you're taught slash commanded to pray as a Christian, how you're taught slash commanded to participate in the sacraments as a Christian. But I'm gonna say it one more time. He had over a decade to adopt the language, mm-hmm. and he didn't adopt it.
Yeah, I don't think the question is whether. I mean, I think it's silly to say like that Luther didn't think the Christian needed the law. Like clearly, he landed on the side of preach the law.
Sure.
Just as we would, and it's just did he use same words as Melanchthon to describe?
What you see
that?
With Luther, though, in terms of horizontal. Act of righteousness, that
right.
aspect of life, is he late 1520s, maybe mid 1520s, he stops using this sort of two kingdom language and he starts focusing on the three estates.
Right. That's
that,
right.
That every human being finds himself living in three different estates, right.
into three different estates.
Yeah, the church or the religious, the state, and then the domestic.
Yeah, and I think that's glorious personally.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you find that in the civil or the table of duties in the Small Catechism.
It's beautiful.
And I mean, I like how you put it. This is just the flow of life. You find yourself in these three particular arenas, and in these arenas, and he's just doing classic. He's in the line of Cicero, for example, and even some medieval ethics or virtue theory, if you want to call it that. That in these particular realms, there are certain obligations
built
that you
in.
Have. Yeah,
built in.
Yeah, that you just.
But don't you think? And I guess this is what I'm getting at. There's a beauty to that that doesn't exist in just simply adopting language.
I think I think that's because Luther always resists, though he could certainly do it. He resists the pull into a sort of scholasticism, that Melanchthon. Luther can do it in Bonhoeffer's The Will.
Yep.
Good heavens. That's remarkable. But he's
first two thirds is literally a scholastic dialectic.
Yeah, he's it's interesting. He's the leader of this Reformation, at least in northern Germany. But he's a fighter.
Yeah.
Whereas Melanchthon's the statesman. You know, he's the one who wants to have the dinner with the 10 different utensils and talk to princes and things.
Yeah, I totally agree with that.
And
I just think there's such a beauty to three estates over three functions.
Yes.
Yeah.
I really do. I just think it's gorgeous. And it's how we live our life.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's
very helpful. I'll say that personally. Very helpful for figuring out.
And it really shuts down the argument because it's implicit to what he's saying that, well, of course, this is a function of the law, at least in some regard. Mm-hmm. I mean,
this was revealed via divine decree.
I'm revealing this to you as what God commands you to do in these estates, right? Or commands/calls you to do in these estates. So certainly in an aspect, the law is functioning here, but it's not just the law functioning here. There's a sense of the gospel, too, that God has given you these estates and called you into the estates and called people into your life in these estates as a gift.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is, man, that's a mind-blowing revelation of how to look at this.
That's not common even in our field of theology. It's almost like sui generis. It's almost like one example over 1,000 years of that sort of thing being done down to the level of daily life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it isn't just law-filled.
Right.
It isn't...
Well, at every corner, it's filled with absolution.
Yeah.
What were you going to say, Adam?
Well, I'm thinking, if you go back to On the Freedom of a Christian, 1520, and then you go to 1523 on temporal authority, where Luther can say things that theoretically sound okay, like, if real Christians don't need government, they don't need authority over them.
But
there are no real Christians.
There you go.
But then in the late 1520s, that sort of idealism, if you will, kind of stops. And there is this focus on the horizontal things in life.
Yes.
Well, I wonder if that is...
But it's always marked by, like you just put it, absolution. So it's always in view of the cross.
Right. So what if... And I'll say it this way. What if the scriptures actually speak in this way that Luther describes, where you are a pagan, right? And you encounter God's devastating law, and then which kills you, and you encounter God's life-breathing gospel, which brings you back to life, right? You're drowned and you're brought back to life. You're killed and you're resurrected. And then you're in this life resurrected, but still in this world that's corrupted by sin and actually still yourself struggling with this.
Yes.
And the reality is that God's law, which killed you, still exists, but actually has already killed you.
Uh-huh.
Has already killed you, and you've already been brought back to life. So then what if the scriptures actually then speak of primarily when you encounter that life and this sort of conundrum that you live, you've already been killed, but yet the law's still here.
End of Romans 7.
You struggled yet, right? Though you, part of you, because of your conversion and your heart of stone being changed to heart of flesh, desires to do the things of God, but fails.
Mm-hmm.
And then speaks of this idea that in an absolution sense, you've been called, the way that this works in everyday life is that God actually calls you into particular estates, and within these estates, you are both served and serve, and that service in both directions is focused on your neighbor's need for you and your need for your neighbor on all levels, right? There's a physical level to that, and there's certainly a spiritual level to that. I need my neighbors in this room to absolve me. I need to be absolved, and they need to be absolved. But I also need you guys to show up to record so that we can do the podcast, right? We need to forgive our children, and our children need to forgive us. But they also need us to provide them with their daily bread and fulfill the fourth commandment.
Yep.
Or the fourth petition of the Lord's Prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And when I would teach this at Concordia, one of the things I would always say is, like, how, if you're Luther, the question of how does God give us this day our daily bread is already an answered question. He gives it to us through other, he answers his prayer through other people. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're not the Israelites. We don't wake up in the morning and stumble out of our tent and see manna laying on the grass.
Right.
If we're going to get this daily bread that we pray for, somebody, some person, he's got to work through some person mm-hmm. in one of their callings mm-hmm. to provide it for us. That's glorious. I mean, that's, I'm not saying three functions of the law or three uses of the law is wrong. I'm just saying
Well, there's something so much more beautiful to that than sitting here and arguing like
what a useless war of words.
That's right.
Not my line, everyone.
I mean, and we that's what gets to me at the end of the day sort of annoying with this is depending on who's arguing it too, you might only get half of it. So you hear somebody say the third use of the law and they're just talking about the pure argument, do Christians need the law? And you're like, okay, that's one part of it. And then you hear the third use of the law and somebody's literally just talking about the law being pedagogical and teaching you things. And you're like, okay, that's part of it. And then you're just arguing one quarter of this piece and one quarter of this piece, and it's just not useful at all. Meanwhile, everybody is actually under the law, and Luther's saying, well, how the heck are we actually going to live like this?
Well, I mean, I guess on my end, just to wrap up, is that I'm a huge fan of the Catechism for this reason. I'm a huge fan of the Three Estates for the same reason. I think it's extremely helpful.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, I mean, we're not quite at our 40 minutes. We'll wrap it up here. For the next episode, we're going to, I mean, we got into why we like the catechisms here. Next episode, I want to break down the difference between the larger and the smaller catechism. You sort of alluded to it. And then that puts us at around 1529. So we'll have some disagreement with radical reformers on the Lord's Supper. That's actually going to be made public here. And then we'll move into, let's say, the origin context of the Augsburg Confession. So thank you for listening to this episode. Like I said, these are a lot of fun to do. We're just trying to go through the timeline, and then all of a sudden, I think like great conversations happen, which is the whole point of the show. It's a lot of fun to be in this room, and I hope that these conversations are coming through as enjoyable takeaways that aren't just sort of textbook history, but are actually helping you understand and value the Reformation in your own life. All right, thank you for listening to this episode. Please rate and subscribe. We'll catch you next time. Bye.